listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it is Friday, the first hour of our program, time for our national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's senator, Senator Bernie Sanders, representing the great state of Vermont. Senator, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Always nice to have you with us. So what's on your plate this week?
What's on my plate? What's on my plate is a profound anger and frustration at the degree to which big money is playing a mammoth role in the political process. Every day you read about the Koch brothers pouring more and more money into the political process, trying to buy the United States Senate now. They already own the Congress to a significant degree, and other organizations just pumping millions and millions. Just reading that in New Hampshire now they're going to put $3 million into that race in a small state, trying to defeat Senator Jeanne Shaheen. And they're doing it in every battleground state in the country. And it just speaks, Tom, to the absolute necessity of overturning this disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision. Because these guys have just unlimited sums of money. Money for them is like, you know, a cup of coffee for you. And without blinking an eye, they can pour just zillions of dollars into the political process. And it is very clear that their goal is to not only own the economy, but to own the political process in this country, own the United States Congress, own governor's chairs all over America. And they're well on the way to doing it. And it is a very, very exasperating situation. People have got to understand that the Koch brothers, who are worth some $80 billion, the second wealthiest family in this country, they have an agenda. And their agenda is out there. David Koch ran for vice president of the United States on the Libertarian Party back in 1980, and his platform was very clear, and that is eliminate Social Security, not cut it, eliminate it, eliminate Medicare, eliminate Medicaid, basically eliminate every federal program that helps working families, the elderly, the children, the sick, the poor, and make, if you're in trouble, if you're unemployed, well, maybe some private charity will help you. If you get cancer when you're 75, well, maybe, you know, some church will help you. But they are determined to destroy every piece of legislation that has been passed in the last 80 years. So these are extreme right-wing guys. They're pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into these elections. And we have got to end American politics, which allows billionaires to buy elections. That's not what American democracy is about. So that is something that is very much on my mind as we look at the campaigns that are 5 weeks away. The other thing I would say, Tom, as somebody who observes the media quite closely, it is interesting about the issues that media focuses on and issues that media doesn't focus on. You know, as a senator, one of the things you learn is that there are a zillion issues out there. I mean, everybody has an issue, and to everybody, that issue is important. Literally hundreds and hundreds of issues that will come across my desk in the course of a year. But I think it's important for us to keep our eyes focused on those very, very profound issues which impact the tens and tens of millions of people in our country. I mean, issues like, which is not talked about terribly much in the media, the collapsing middle class. Simple question, why is it that with a huge increase in productivity, so that almost every worker in America today is able to produce more than he or she used to, yet despite that, median family income has gone down by $5,000 since 1999. Male workers, men in this country, make $286 less in inflation accounted for dollars than they did back in 44 years ago. Can you imagine that?
Yeah. Reaganomics. What a success.
Well, Reaganomics, there's a whole lot of reasons why, but it's important that we understand that. You look out there and you see these guys are really angry. Well, you know why they're angry? Because 44 years later, in inflation accounted for dollars, they're making $280 less than they made then. What sense is that? Women are making $1,700 less last year than they did in 2007. 95% of all new income generated. You know, there's a lot of discussion about GDP. It's important. But what's more important to understand is no matter what the GDP is, 95% of all new income goes to the top 1%. So that's an issue that has got to be laid out there. Now, people may have differences of opinion as to why it has occurred, differences of opinion as to how we can rectify it. But bottom line is we have got to focus on this issue. Why is the middle class collapsing? Why is almost all new income going to the top 1%? Why do we in this country have the most extreme wealth and income inequality of any major country on earth? Top 1% own 37% of the wealth. Bottom 60% own 1.7%. That is called oligarchy, where a handful of people have extraordinary wealth and power. The other issue I think that we have got to continue to focus on, media does for fairly obvious reasons, I think, especially television, a terrible job on. And that is the role that Citizens United is playing in opening the floodgates of billionaire money into the political process. Now, the television stations and networks, they love it because this is like just incredible amounts of money in the bank for them. TV is now full of all these ads paid for by the Koch brothers and other guys. And it's great for television. You think they're going to be talking about the impact, the negative impact, horrendous impact that money has on the political process? I don't think so. Global warming. I, a couple of weeks ago, participated in a huge demonstration in New York City. Bill McKibben, a good friend of mine from Ripton, Vermont, was one of the organizers of that with his group, 350.org. 400,000 people out there saying the scientific community is united. Global warming is the major planetary crisis that we face. The situation is bad now. It'll only get worse. We've got to focus on that issue. We've got to focus on issues of health care. In my view, the Affordable Care Act has gave us some progress, but we remain the only major country on earth that does not guarantee health care to all people as a right of citizenship, and yet we are spending almost twice as much per capita on health care as do the people of any other nation. Why is that? Why are 40 million people in this country without any health insurance? Why do millions of people pay high deductibles and copayments? Can we come up with a Medicare for all single-payer system which provides health care to all people in a more cost-effective way? Social safety net, huge issue. It is no great secret that the Republicans want to do quote-unquote entitlement reform, and I beg people that when you hear anybody on TV talking about entitlement reform, all that means is they don't have the guts to look you in the face and say, we're going to cut Social Security, we're going to cut Medicare. That's exactly what they mean. So you got virtually all Republicans and some Democrats, a few Democrats, who also believe in that. And yet the American people are very clear, with senior poverty increasing, with millions of seniors out there, often women, trying to get by on $12,000, $13,000, $14,000 a year, the last thing you're going to do is cut Social Security. In fact, you have to expand Social Security. And then my Republican friends say, well, we have a budget deficit. We got to cut, cut, cut. Well, what they forget to tell you is that one out of four large corporations in this country, profitable large corporations, pay zero in taxes. We lose $100 billion every single year of revenue because corporate America is storing their profits in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda or other tax havens rather than in the United States. In 1952, 32% of all of the revenue that came into the federal government was from corporate taxation. Today, it is less than 10%. So that's an issue that we have to focus on. So my point here is there are a million issues we can spend our lives worrying about, you know, the Secret Service and guarding the White House and all that stuff. All of that is important. But let's focus on the major issues facing working families in this country. Let's rally support for alternatives, for policy, which protects the needs of the average American.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Sanders will be taking your calls right after the break, the next hour, for the rest of the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov.gov. And also you can find him on Facebook and Twitter quite easily. And welcome back. Bob, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV satellite in Arlington. Is that Washington or Virginia?
Washington.
Washington. Okay, I didn't know there was an Arlington, Washington. I saw it there. I thought it was a typo. Bob, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator. I'm a disabled vet on partial disability, And for me to vote, I have to pay a poll tax because I have to pay postage. And I just don't have the money. And when I, you know, Rachel Maddow during the general election showed some of the punitive ballots that the Republicans whipped up that would cost $3 to mail, we shouldn't be paying postage on voting in the first place.
Well, I think that, Bob, that's a very, very good point. You know, voting is what democracy is about, and we should not have to charge people for the privilege of voting. And, of course, you raise one issue, but probably even the deeper issue is the fact that many Republican states around this country, they're working overtime to do everything they can to make it harder for lower-income people to vote, for older people to vote, require them to pay money or go long distances to get IDs so that they can come out to vote. You know, my belief, my strong belief, is that we should do everything that we can to facilitate the voting process. There are countries around the world where if you're over their voting age, 18 often, you're automatically registered to vote. Thomas, that's the case in Canada, I think, isn't it?
I believe so. I don't.
Yeah. And you know, the goal is we want as many people to participate as possible. That's what those of us who believe in democracy, you know, feel. But unfortunately, you got other guys who really don't particularly believe in democracy. Their idea is democracy is keep as many people away as possible who might vote against you and then take enormous amounts of money for rich people. And that's the way they see democracy. So, Bob, I think you raise a very good point.
Patricia in Portage, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders and Tom. I'm following up on a call I made a couple months ago about relisting our wolves. In Wisconsin, they have killed half our wolves in 2 years and still claim the population is right up there, and they're going after them, and they're killing in contests in Idaho. And I write columns about this for the Capital Times, and it is devastating for all of us to know that our large carnivores and mammals and biodiversity are being destroyed across this country and across this world for trophy killing serial killers who love, cannot wait to get the rarest animals and mount them on their walls. We need the wolves relisted.
Patricia, we have 30 seconds. Let's let the senator answer.
Okay, Patricia, I am very sympathetic to what you're saying. I mean, to be attacking endangered species for trophies is makes no sense at all. But I have to plead ignorance to the particular situation in Wisconsin, so I don't know enough about it.
Okay. We'll be back with we just have 5 seconds, right? 10 seconds, okay.
Well, 10 seconds goes very, very quickly.
It does. Indeed it does.
Well, you're laughing away.
Yeah. We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders taking your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. Be sure to check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. Stick around. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past. Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. And Dwayne in Michigan, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator. It's a real honor to speak to you. My question is that I've heard you several times say that they need to drive voters to the polls. If they use voter suppression and said that it's un-American and it's being done by Republicans across the country on a national ad campaign, it seems like that would just drive probably presidential numbers to the polls.
Tom, I'm not sure that
Dwayne, I'm not. I don't understand what you're saying either.
Well, I you know.
The Democrats won't. They seem like they're afraid to mention voter suppression on a national issue as a national issue.
I don't.
That's out saying if you're a Democrat, you better vote or you won't vote in 16. I think people would be driven to the polls.
Good point. Okay. Well, I think that's a good point. We have to, and I think there are states, North Carolina and elsewhere, where these issues are being raised. And you know, there is some backlash to it among people who are saying, really, you don't want me to vote? Well, I'm going to make a double effort to get out to vote. But, you know, Republicans are not stupid, and they have thought these things out, and they understand that if they can make it difficult for lower-income people who are likely to vote against them, for older people who may be voting against them, they see in the long run, despite the bad publicity, that it works to their benefits. But, you know, I have always believed, and I mean this passionately, you know, when I run in elections, I want the voter turnout to be as high as possible. And if I can't defend my views and what I stand for before large numbers of people, well, you know what, then I shouldn't be running. And for these people who are just cowards, they understand that when you drill down into what they believe, which is often tax breaks for the rich, unfettered free trade, cuts in programs that impact the elderly or working families, that the more people know about what they stand for, the less likely they're going to get votes. And they understand that, and then what they try to do is just make it hard for people to vote. So, you know, and the other thing that they do is get involved in character assassination, just personal and personal and personal attacks, running away from issues, demonizing opponents, which makes people then just give up on the whole political process. So, you know, we've got to overcome that. We've got to raise political consciousness in this country. We have to have people familiar with what the real issues are and what the parties stand for and what candidates stand for.
Yeah. I saw a great thing on it was one of those little Facebook boxes a couple of days ago that said, if America was really a center-right nation, Republicans would not be engaging in voter suppression. They would be encouraging people to get to the polls.
Right.
And I think that's an excellent point. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thanks, Senator, for standing up for all Americans. I can vouch for what you were saying. In my state, the Koch brothers and other selfish billionaires are running thousands of ads lying about Gary Peters and Mark Schauer and everybody else. But anyway, if the Republicans control Congress this election and in 2016, it won't matter if you, Hillary, or Roosevelt is president. There will be zero progress. Do you think progressives should continue to nitpick that some Democrats aren't perfect, or should we work to defeat the real enemies of progress, the Republicans?
Well, Paul, that's a great question. And I think what ends up happening is that for some reason, it is very easy for progressive types to be critical of each other. And, you know, that's fine. And I have been critical of President Obama. I was on the floor for 10 hours in opposition to the tax breaks that he gave to people who shouldn't have given it. And that's fine. But I think Paul's point is a very good point. And that is we lose track of the role of the Republican Party. What do they stand for? What role have they been playing in Congress for the last 6 years? And very often, you know, I go on the media and people say, well, shouldn't Obama do more about global warming? Yeah, he should. But you know what? President Obama recognizes the reality of global warming. He has tried to do something. He's done more than anybody else has done. Should he do more? Yeah. But the real issue when you talk about global warming is, if you can believe it, you have a major political party called the Republican Party that not only is not doing anything, they don't even believe the scientific evidence about the reality of global warming. Should Obama do more about creating jobs? Yeah, he should. But you have a Republican Party that time after time after time has done everything that they can to prevent us from investing in rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure and creating millions of jobs. So I think Paul's point is right. And then last and most important point is, if you look at the Republican record of obstructionism, they have made it, you know, almost impossible for the president to be able to get ambassadorships appointed to small countries around the world. And they object to almost everything. So you're having hundreds of filibusters out there which have paralyzed the Congress and made it impossible for us to address the very, very serious problems facing this country. So I think Paul's point is right. People can be critical of anybody they want to be. Be critical of me, fine. Critical of Obama, fine. Elizabeth Warren, fine. But understand what's going on in this country. And now that is that the Koch brothers and others have helped create an extreme right-wing party, which is there to represent the wealthy and the powerful, and is at war with the middle class and working families of this country.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us in our hour-long national town hall meeting. Brunch with Bernie on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with your calls, more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can plug Bernie Sanders into Facebook and Twitter and easily find his Facebook page and his Twitter feed. All kinds of great stuff. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our National Town Hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, on the Tom Harbin program. And Jim, in Lockport, Illinois, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, how are you?
I'm great, Jim.
With this voter ID law in Wisconsin, I was just wondering, how can the American people actually support a party that tries to take rights away? The first ones out there saying liberties and freedoms, and here they take all these rights away. This isn't a driver's license where it's a privilege. This is a right.
Right.
And they should never interfere with that.
Well, Jim, I think you raise a great question. It speaks to absolute hypocrisy of the Republican Party, which talks about individual freedom and responsibility and all that. And then they work overtime to try to make it hard for people to exercise their very constitutional right to determine who their governor or president or senator is going to be. What I think this is about is, as the Republican Party has moved to the right, their agenda is so extreme that the more people understand what they really stand for, and what they stand for is pretty clear. Read the Paul Ryan budget. That's the budget passed by the U.S. House of Representatives, and what they stand for is more tax breaks for the wealthy and large corporations. What they stand for is ending Medicare as we know it, converting it into a voucher program. Under Bush, they were hot to trot to privatize Social Security, and I think in the back of many of their minds, that's still where they want to go with that. Massive cuts in Medicaid, massive cuts in food stamps, in education, making it harder for workers to form unions, attacking the Postal Service. That is their agenda. And the more people know about that agenda, the fewer, little less support that they're going to get. So the way you win elections is two ways. You make it harder for people to vote, and you go to the Koch brothers and billionaires to buy the elections for you. And you'll note that the ads that the Republicans run have nothing to do with their ideology. You're not going to see, I may be wrong, I don't look at the ads in 50 states, but I will be very surprised if any Republican candidate has an ad that says, vote for me. I want to give more tax breaks for billionaires and millionaires, and I want to cut your Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and I would appreciate your support. That's not what they talk about. That is the Koch brothers' agenda. But that's not what these candidates talk about, because they know nobody supports that. So what they do is engage in these wild personal attacks against people or whatever. But when you have nothing to defend, then your goal is to make it difficult for people to vote.
Bob, in Raleigh, North Carolina, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Senator Sanders. Thank you both for your service. And Senator Sanders, thanks for coming to Raleigh a few weeks ago.
Yeah, that was a great event. I loved it. Thank you very much, Bob.
Great to be there. I was there, actually, with my wife, so we like to show some Southern hospitality to you. So I'll go to my question, and that is regards to Medicare. And my mother, who was a senior and recently passed away, but during her time before then, there's a clause in Medicare where you have Medicare coverage, full coverage, if you can stay out of the hospital basically for 60 days between admissions. What happened was she could not stay healthy enough between admissions, so that what happened was the first admission, she stayed on that essentially, and there's a clause where you have like 45 days of coverage. I mean, there's normal Medicare coverage and then 45, like they call it, lifetime days. Then after that, you're on the hook for whatever the cost of the hospitalization is. And I just wanted to ask you the question, is there anything you could do to help change that? And for anybody else out there who may be encountering that, it's a kind of a gotcha that Medicare has in the system. Thank you for your service to both of you guys.
Well, Bob, thanks very much for the call. No, that clause makes no sense to me as best as I can understand it. And, what I would say to Bob is that, Bob, we are the only major country on earth that doesn't have a national health care program guaranteeing health care to all of our people. And Medicare is a very popular program, and Medicare does a lot of good things, but it is far from perfect, and we want to strengthen it. And we want to oppose the Republican efforts to weaken it, to raise the eligibility age of Medicare, to cut back on various benefits. So you raise a very good point, and I think that's something we should pay attention to and try to address.
Danette in Hinesville, Georgia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Senator Sanders. What is the United States policy on preventing people from the West African countries from entry into our country to avoid what we have going on right now with the gentleman in Dallas? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Jeanette, that is an excellent question, and I don't have the answer in front of me. I would hope and expect that we would make certain that people are screened who come from any place in the world where there is a dangerous and contagious disease, and I suspect that that is the case. But that is a very good question, and I can't give you a definitive answer. But common sense suggests that when you have something like Ebola, which tragically is a very contagious disease, that we want to do everything possible to contain it and not see it spread.
Robert in Naples, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Robert? Let's try Barbara in Auburn, Washington. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning. My question for the senator is, how is it that the Republicans have been able to get away with taking votes away? We pay their salary. They use our tax dollar to take our vote away. And everyone who can't vote is either getting welfare, food stamps, Social Security. So the government thinks enough to give them government funds to take care of them. But those IDs aren't good enough to vote. What is wrong with that?
Well, what is wrong is it is no secret. I mean, the argument that the Republicans use is voter fraud, voter fraud. Well, no one believes in voter fraud. Voter fraud, if it occurs, is a very serious problem and should be punished very severely, in my view. But the truth is there is very, very little voter fraud in this country. Now, interestingly enough, when we talk about this whole business, there is a Republican state called North Dakota that has very liberal and open and inclusive voting rules. It is one of the easiest states to vote in. It's a Republican state. They don't have any problems. I talked to somebody from North Dakota. I said, well, you're wide open, you know, voting here. And do you have any problems? No, they don't have any problems. So what the Republicans have tried to do under the argument that they're trying to prevent voter fraud is make it more difficult for lower-income people to get the identification that they need to vote. That's just the simple reality. Everybody knows it. And, you know, that's what right-wing Republicans do. And it is, as I mentioned several times today, to my mind, it is cowardly and it is an insult to democracy. And it's something that we have got to end.
Let's see here. Bob in Bellevue, Washington. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hello? Is that Bob in Bellevue?
That's you, Bob. You're on the air.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you, Senator Sanders. I went to school in the middle 50s, halfway between Burlington and Rutland. But my question is was inspired by Bob in Arlington, which is in Squamish County. I'm in King County. We have statewide in Washington voting by mail.
Right.
But we also, most counties have ballot drop boxes. And but I'm concerned, why isn't there more publicity for Washington's system, which probably produces the best turnout, voter turnout, anywhere in the country?
Yeah, Oregon does the same.
Bob, that's a great question. My understanding, Tom, well, Bob, if you're still on, correct me if I'm wrong, but Washington has one of the highest voter turnouts, don't they?
Yeah, Washington and Oregon State, which also does. Oregon is completely vote by mail. I lived there for 5 years, and it's yeah, incredibly high voter turnout.
Okay, well, I think Bob's point is right. You know, there are people, including myself, who like to cast a ballot on Election Day, but I think we should utilize any and all strategies to increase voter turnout. And Washington deserves a lot of kudos and respect for working with Oregon, I guess, Oregon going forward as well, in making it easier for people to participate. And the proof is in the pudding that we're looking at high voter turnouts. So maybe in this country, instead of the Republicans working overtime to prevent people from voting, we should be focusing on what Washington and Oregon are doing to increase voter turnout.
Yeah, we have just 35 seconds until the break.
You know, this issue, Tom, I mean, what people have got to appreciate is there is a political war going on in this country. And these Republicans, backed by their big money interests, are doing anything and everything that they can to gain control of the United States government. That's what they're trying to do. And voter suppression and making it harder for people to vote and getting the support of billionaires who are putting unbelievable sums of money into the political process. That's what modern day politics is about. And we have got to do everything we can to educate, to organize, to surprise people and have a much higher voter turnout than the pundits believe will be the case.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, here on the Tom Hartman program. Right after this, it's 15 minutes with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can check out Sanders.Senate.gov for Bernie's website. Great news aggregation site, all kinds of great stories there. Plus, you can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, his newsletter. And welcome back. James in Colgate, Oklahoma, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. You are on the air with Senator Sanders. James?
Yes, Senator Sanders.
Yes.
I live in a Republican state, hate it, but I'm a veteran and 80% service connected. I draw $1,652 a month, and I get a small royalty check. Well, the Affordable Care Act came along, and they want I'm a veteran, and I'm covered through the veterans. You know, health care. But for my wife, she's been in the hospital six times in the last 3 years. So when I went to, you know, sign up for her, I wanted the smallest deductible.
This is with Obamacare.
Be $1,500. And we really don't even have that, but we would for a couple of times. But it was $460 a month. You know, for her, because we in the state of Oklahoma, we you know, since we don't have to file taxes, I draw a little more money through my, you know, royalty check. You know, and file taxes, it would have been a little bit less than that, but that would have still really put a person in a bind. So, you know, how is a person going? And let me put this in. Was already paying about, I'd have to figure it up and get it out, my papers out and look at everything. But was paying almost $360, $380 a month in medical bills before.
So, James, is your question, how can a person living on disability afford Obamacare for their spouse?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Okay, let me, James, are you still on?
He still is on there.
Okay, yeah. James, are you getting your health care at the VA?
Yes.
How's that working for you?
Well, it's working, you know. I can't complain. You know, there have been a lot of complaints about it, but I'm glad to have it.
Good. So it's working.
I'm really glad to have it.
Okay. Well, I think James raises an issue that others this afternoon have raised as well. And that is that we have a healthcare system which is totally inadequate. In virtually every major country on Earth, the problems that James just articulated would not be the case. People go to the doctor. It is publicly funded, and they get the care that they need, often without any out-of-pocket expense as well. So I think what James is raising is the fundamental philosophical issue. Should health care be a right, R-I-G-H-T, of all Americans, or should it not be? And if it's a right, then people should not, people who don't have a whole lot of money like James, should not be asked to come up for, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month to take care of his wife. That's wrong. And the bottom line here is everybody has got to understand this, that our health care system not only has 40 million people who are uninsured, but many families like James that are underinsured, and yet we end up spending per person almost twice as much per capita on health care as other nations. We can do a lot better than that.
We'll be back with more of your questions for Senator Sanders right after this. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, a national town hall meeting. Senator, I had a quick question, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
In the face of this Ebola case popping up in Texas, I keep waiting for one of these reporters to stick a microphone in either Rick Perry or any Republican in Texas's face and ask the simple question, now that you have Ebola in Texas and you have a quarter of your population uninsured, which means that, you know, if they're sick and they're showing symptoms, they might not go to the doctor. Isn't it time to take Medicaid expansion?
Good question, Tom. And, you know, and one of the points that people make correctly is, and I don't claim to be, you know, I'm not a doctor or an expert on this, but obviously, you know, one of the reasons that Ebola is wrecking havoc in poor African countries is their healthcare infrastructure is very, very weak. And the stronger your infrastructure is, the more people have insurance, the stronger our public health system is, the better able we can check and address issues like epidemics. But I think that when in a state like Texas or other states in this country, we have so many people uninsured, so many people not going to the doctor. You know, what you're asking, I think, is what happens if somebody comes down with Ebola and can't afford to go to a doctor, right?
Right. Yeah.
And what's the implication? But you don't have to even look at Ebola. There are other infections out there where people are sick, don't go to the doctor, and those diseases spread.
Right. They also have no paid sick day law down there. So, you know,
That's right. So that makes the contagion issue.
Right. All the worse. All the worse. Leon in Heathsville, Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders. How about fair trade instead of free trade? It would even help the third world countries, our importers, and our exports also.
Well, Leon, you know, you're talking to two guys, Tom and me, who, you know, have been preaching that gospel for many, many years. In the last 15 or so years, Leon, we have lost about 60,000 factories in America and millions of decent-paying jobs. Now, not all of that is attributable to the trade policies that we have. But a lot of it is. And the bottom line is that NAFTA, CAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China, other trade policies are pushed by corporate America so that they can throw Americans out on the street here, move to low-wage countries, pay people pennies an hour, and then bring their products back into this country. It has been a very, very positive development for corporate America. It has been a disaster for working families. And it's not only the jobs that workers lose when their companies move to China or elsewhere. It is also the pressure that companies can put on workers in a drive, in a race to the bottom by saying, look, if you're not prepared to take cuts in your health care benefits or you're not prepared to take cuts in your wages, we're going to move to China. You make the choice. And workers then have to swallow and take those cuts. So to my mind, it has been, these trade policies have been a disaster. But by the way, you know, I started off this program by saying that we had to focus on the most important issues that affect working families. Tom, you tell me, how often is trade discussed on television? Ever?
Virtually not at all, but the big corporations own the TV networks,
right.
So the ones who are benefiting from our
So this is an issue of huge consequence. You know, there are young people in this country who go shopping who really don't know that there was once a time when you could buy products made in the United States of America and not in China. They don't know that because that's all that you see in the stores. But this is, again, one of the very, very important issues that is not discussed for obvious economic issues. The TV networks and corporate America loves our trade policy, so why discuss it?
Rick, in Geneva, Florida, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon. Given that the Republicans seem to have to cheat and lie to win, one of their basic lies is this distinction between makers and takers. And you hear it from Paul Ryan or Mitt Romney, you know, that all these great capitalists, they make the profits, and these other people are just sitting around collecting benefit checks. But if you get hired by a capitalist for $10 an hour, he knows that you're going to produce $20 an hour for him, 10 for you and 10 for him. And if he doesn't make a profit on you, why would he hire you?
Right.
So the worker is the profit maker. Without the worker putting his productive time into the business, there is no profit. Capitalist sits on his wide rear end and collects profits.
Okay, Rick, let's let Senator Sanders respond.
Pick up on Rick's point and say this. Henry Ford, a well-known capitalist, understood something, a very, very profound point, and that is what type of policies stimulate the economy and generate jobs. And way back when, he decided to take the revolutionary act of paying his workers $5 an hour, $5 a day.
Yeah.
And what was he? That was in the early
1900s. This is the 20s, as I recall. And the Dodge brothers were paying a dollar a day, and that's why they sued him in the Michigan Supreme Court.
Right. So Dodge was paying a dollar a day.
And Ford had been.
And he quintupled the wages, raised by five times the wages that he had been paying.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary. And the reason that he did it, when asked, why did you do it? He said, well, if workers don't have the money in their hands, how are they going to buy my cars? And to answer Rick's question, that is the fundamental economic issue. In my view, this business of tax breaks for the rich and trickle-down economics is a fraud. It's a total fraud. When you give tax breaks to the rich and large corporations, the rich and large corporations get richer. If you want to stimulate the economy, you have to put money into the hands of the vast majority of the people. That means pay people decent wages and create jobs so that people have income. And when people have income, they're going to go out and buy products. They're going to go out and purchase services. And when you do that, you create jobs. So that is why many of us are in favor of a massive jobs program to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure, to raise the minimum wage to a living wage, to deal with the trade issue that we just discussed a moment ago, so the companies invest in America, not in China.
Senator, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday. And Joe Rahm's going to drop by in a 30. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday. Just a couple of things to toss into the hopper for your consideration and evaluation. The Pennsylvania porn scandal. This is bizarre. The Republican governor of Pennsylvania running for re-election, Tom Corbett, apparently brought with him a couple of people from when he was whatever he was before he was governor, who were really into mailing porn around. And now it's going public, and it's a bit of a problem. Two of them just resigned. This is not good. Okay, number one. Number two, Walmart is saying, hey, let's get into the banking business. And they've been having a real challenge. Now, there's a lot of people who don't have the ability to write a check. One out of 13 households in the United States. Lynn Stewart Paramore wrote a great piece about this over at alternate.org. A third of people living in Starr County, Texas, for example, can't write a check. And so what do? They go to these payday lenders and these other predators who just, you know, basically rip them off. So Walmart's looking at that going, hey, we make a living ripping off poor people, right? Whether they're working for us or our customers, we make a living ripping off poor people. Let's do it with banking. And in fact, they are going to, they're proposing that there will be a visit to an out-of-network ATM. We'll get you a $2.50 charge, minimum deposit of $20 required. If you don't keep a balance of $500 a month, you get hit with a fee of $8.95, et cetera, et cetera. Now, arguably, this is better than some of the big banks, but still, it's Walmart. What's the solution to this? It's what Bernie suggested. Let post offices issue checking accounts. This is how it's done in most countries. The post office also, you know, is involved in the banking sector, particularly for people who don't need fancy banking services. They just need basic bare bones banking services at no cost or at very, very low cost. Post office can provide that just fine, thank you very much. Our post office can't, of course, because it's prevented by law from doing that. We should change that law. Okay. Mark Fiore has a great cartoon. It's I saw it over at Daily Kos. Mark has his own website. I'm sorry, I don't have the URL for it right in front of me. But he's talking about the security breaches. You know, this guy Omar Gonzalez, who hopped the White House fence and ended up, you know, with a knife in his pocket, ended up back in the green room. Mark Fiore is essentially asking the question, why is nobody pointing out that this guy, you know, the irony of the situation, that it was the White House where George W. Bush lied us into the war in Iraq that caused Omar Gonzalez to end up with PTSD, which caused him, arguably, to freak out and run into the White House. Back during Vietnam, we used to have this expression, the war comes home, the war always comes home, the war is coming home. Why isn't anybody pointing this out? Here in the incredible irony department, I mean, there's enough irony there for the whole day, but in the incredible irony department, down in Arkansas, there's a woman by the name of Leslie Rutledge who's running for AG, for Attorney General, top cop in the state. Now, Arkansas recently passed it being a Republican, you know, having a Republican legislature and having a not inconsequential African-American population. Bernie mentioned during the last hour how, you know, isn't it interesting that North Dakota, which is a Republican state, has the least restrictive voting rules in the entire United States. You can register to vote and vote on the same day. They have early voting. They have mail-in voting. They have everything. You know, it's super convenient and easy to vote. And you don't have to show ID. You just have to sign, you know, saying, yes, I swear under penalty of perjury and going to prison for 2 years, that I am who I say I am and I'm eligible to vote. That's all you have to do. North Dakota is virtually all white. If you look across the United States, what you find is that the states where Republicans have been introducing voter suppression laws, whether they're voter ID laws or purge the voter list laws, or, you know, all of the above. Actually, most of these voter suppression efforts are fairly comprehensive and multifaceted. The states where they do this are the states that have substantial minority populations and or swing states. They don't care about North Dakota. They don't need to suppress, you know, they don't care about vote. Oh, there's no voter fraud in North Dakota. It's all white people and Republican white people. They're not going to ignore the fact that many of the actual 31 cases of voter fraud that have been caught and prosecuted in the last 14 years were Republicans. So anyhow, here's this Republican, Leslie Rutledge, who's running for AG in Arkansas. And it turns out that under the voter suppression law that was passed by the Arkansas legislature, if you register to vote in another state and you forgot to cancel your registration, which, by the way, is probably the case for a third of Americans who have moved in the last couple of years. I mean, just ask yourself, how many times in your life, grew up in Michigan, I lived in Lansing and Detroit, and up in the Upper Peninsula, We moved to New Hampshire, then we moved to Georgia, then we moved to Germany, then we moved back to Georgia, then we moved to Vermont, then we moved to Oregon, and now I'm in Washington, D.C. And every time I move someplace new, I register to vote. And I just, frankly, always assumed that my old state would notice that I wasn't there anymore. You know, something would bounce, or maybe the new state would notify them. Now, this last time around, just to make sure, I actually sent a letter off to Oregon saying, I'm not in your state anymore. But, you know, and then that's also so that I don't get jury duty notices and ignore them and end up on a, you know, arrest warrant list or something. But Leslie Rutledge, but so as part of the voter suppression efforts, they say, hey, you know, who moves more frequently, rich people or poor people? Well, it turns out, I'm not a rich person, but you know, the general rule of thumb is that the lower people are on the socioeconomic ladder, the more likely they are to move periodically looking for work. So, hey, let's make it so that it's easy to suppress the vote of people who recently moved. And so they passed that law in Arkansas. And here's the story by Aviva Shen over at thinkprogress.org. Arkansas Attorney General candidate Leslie Rutledge is crying foul over the cancellation of her voter registration form. Rutledge, the Republican nominee for Attorney General, was kicked off the voting rolls after it was discovered that she had failed to cancel previous voter registrations in Washington, D.C. and Virginia and re-register in Pulaski County, where she moved. She's calling this a dirty trick, right? They note at Think Progress, it is very common, becoming even more common after the state implemented a number of strict voter restrictions. In fact, the chair of the Democratic Party in that state said, quote, 1,000 eligible voters had their absentee ballots thrown out earlier this year following the implementation of these new guidelines. In Ohio, some voters have even been criminally prosecuted for fraud because they followed flawed instructions. During voter purges in Florida and Colorado, many eligible voters were removed for similar reasons that Rutledge was. Outdated address, a typo, it flags you as fraudulent. Boom, boom, off you go. So, you know, and now the Republican National Lawyers Association has come to her defense saying, this is outrageous! She was systematically, I'm quoting from them, systematically removed from voter rolls within 90 days of a federal election. That's outrageous. Guess who was pushing for the voter purge? The law. The Republican National Lawyers Association. Ironically, they note over Think Progress, the RNLA has been instrumental in pushing mass voter purges across the country, specifically defending the right to purge voters within 90 days of the election. Right. Okay, and finally, before the Ebola failure at Dallas Memorial or Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital, they're seeing long lines and long waits in the ER in this hospital. And this appears to be part of the problem of why this guy with Ebola showed up at the hospital and got given antibiotics and sent home. Why do they have long waits? Because Rick Perry won't expand Medicaid. People are going to the ER because that's the only doctor they can see.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Once again, Republican policies in Texas are setting the state up for an Ebola crisis. And welcome back. Michael watching Free Speech TV in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, thanks for watching Free Speech. What's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. I just want to get sarcastic about religion, since it's Anything Goes Friday.
Okay.
Now, Ebola is just an organism trying to survive, like any human being. Anything, again, this is sarcasm. So if these people who believe in the Bible, that the world is only 6,000 years old, that would mean God created everything, which would mean God created Ebola. So how can a person hate an organism that God made that's just trying to stay alive? What do you think?
It does raise some of the really existential questions that religion attempts to answer. You know, like, you know, why is there suffering? Why do people die? All those kind of things. Interesting, Michael. Interesting.
Okay. Thanks
a lot for the call. That's a good one for Anything Goes Friday. Christy, maybe somebody has an answer. Christy in Perrysburg, Ohio, watching Free Speech TV on Roku. Hey, Christy, what's up?
Good afternoon. Long time listener.
Thank you.
First time caller. I wanted to mention long term planning for world peace. I have an idea. Mm-hmm. It will not solve current problems, but we have to get into some strategic planning. So my idea is, and I have a moveon.org petition going on for this too, is that President Obama work with Congress and the United Nations to hold a World Congress, convene a convention just to set up a world peace plan.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the core methods in this peace plan would have to be that it would be a framework for how to respond to one rogue nation invading another, or groups like ISIS. And it would require all the nations, not just one or two like the U.S. and France and Britain, to respond in unity to put down this event. And it could be even from court proceedings, fines, sanctions, but if that doesn't remedy it, it would mean that all those countries would combine forces to put down this military, or could even be financial sanctions on these countries.
You know, what you're describing, Christy, is what was envisioned by the United Nations, and arguably exactly what the United Nations Charter says. It's just really difficult to get everybody to go along with it.
Well, when they invented the Security Council, that one nation can put down an idea,
right,
it kind of squelches that whole idea, whole premise.
The idea of consensus, absolute consensus, was, you know...
And it would relieve a lot of financial responsibilities on the part of just one or two nations.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, as one rogue nation after another is put down, then fewer will try to get away with that.
Yeah, it could be.
I could,
Christy?
Mention.
Yeah, great idea, Christy. Thank you for calling and sharing. It's 20 minutes past the hour. By the way, did you see this in the New York Times? Ben Bernanke, who's got an $800,000 home here in Washington, D.C., right in this neighborhood where I'm broadcasting from, Capitol Hill area, tried to get a refi. The bank wouldn't refinance his home, even though he's got a $1 million book deal. He makes $250,000 for every speech he gives. The bank would not refinance his home because he recently changed jobs. Seriously, I'm not making this up. You can read it in the New York Times. Neil Irwin writing it. The headline is, Why Ben Bernanke Can't Refinance His Home. It's incredible. Dan in Germany. Hey, Dan, thanks for listening or watching over at TomHartman.com. What's up in Germany?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, everything's great here in Germany. We're celebrating unification.
Mm-hmm.
Einheitstag Day.
Yeah.
And we're having a great time.
So today is the anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall? The
anniversary of the wall going down, yeah.
Wow. So what kind of celebration is happening in Germany? What does it look like?
Well, in our town, they're having a Fußgänger rally,
mm-hmm,
which means a walk.
Right.
A bunch of people will be walking the whole town. It's about maybe 2-3 mile walk.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans are great walkers.
Yeah.
Totally. Heidi and I didn't go, but we read about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also wanted to thank you for all your work here. I've been listening to you on the internet, and I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm what they call a socialist,
mm-hmm,
so I'm actually with you.
Which is fairly common in Europe, by the way.
Yeah, of course, Germany is a socialist democracy, I call it.
Yep.
And
well, they call it that,
basically,
too.
Basically, yeah. I think you lived in Germany, didn't you?
I did, 86, 87.
Yeah, yeah. So you know the system here, and
mm-hmm,
I enjoy it very much. I've been here for 25 or 30 years, I think.
So you're an American expat. I assume you married a German.
Yeah,
is that?
Expat. I worked for the U.S. government, retired over here.
Uh-huh.
And I'm enjoying my life. I go back to California, though, in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Southern California. So,
yeah.
But I just wanted to call and thank you for all your work with the Progressive Party, and I really appreciate you.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Very much.
Thank you for your very kind words, and thanks for listening to us in Germany. And you know, whenever anything's, we just had the news story yesterday that Germany has now officially abolished college tuition countrywide. Lower Saxony just got on the program. Every other state had abolished it. You know, whenever you see something like that fly by your radar screen, feel free to call in and let us know about it, okay?
Yeah, I will. My wife, I don't read German that well. My wife reads the paper and tells me,
uh-huh.
and everything's going on, so I keep up with it. But, she went through 6 years of school here, college, without paying anything.
Right. Yeah, there's nobody in Germany who has student loans. I mean, it's like, and there's nobody in Germany who gets sick and goes broke, because you have a national health insurance program, and you have a national health care program, and you have free education. It's mind-boggling. Dan, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. I look forward to talking to you. Thank you. Lee in Los Angeles. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Big fan. Just before I get to my point, I really hope that Bernie runs, and I think he's just the voice for everything that's wrong with this country. And I hope he's not perceived as too extreme. You know, I think he holds a lot.
Bernie's right where the vast majority of Americans are. That's, you know, this myth that America is a center-right nation is just complete nonsense. If America was a center-right nation, Republicans would not be pushing voter suppression laws. They would be trying to make it easier and easier and easier for people to vote, because if the majority of people would vote, you know, center-right, which is Republican, then, hey, they'd win elections all the time. Instead, they're trying to suppress the vote because America's a center-left nation.
That's right, and I think he's going to come off a lot more embracingly with the American people than Ron Paul.
Oh, yeah. Well, Ron Paul is to the right of the right, so there's that, too.
Now, here's my point. I'm an educator, been so for 24 years. My wife's 28,
mm-hmm.
and across the country there's a big movement by the billionaires and people like Bill Gates and Eli Broad to... Unfortunately, Obama got kind of duped in, and Arne Duncan underneath have disseminated this Common Core.
Right.
I don't know how well read you are on that, but it's kind of caused a great stir that's building momentum across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It has never been tested. The data isn't there. And it's going to eventually try to tie in test scores with student achievement. So I just wanted to see if you had any opinions on that, or that whole movement, you know, with the Bill Gates and usage of software and hardware is no coincidence. It's replacing the testing that previously went on.
Yeah.
And it's all, in my opinion, part of the big movement to privatize education for profit.
I don't disagree. Back when I was writing Unequal Protection in 2001, I think it was, I was living in Vermont, and Jim Jeffords had just quit the Republican Party over the Republican Party's policies with regard to standardized testing nationwide and the Help America, or not Help America, but the No Child Left Behind law. And I met with Senator Jeffords and his staff, and they pointed out to me, they had the Congressional Research Service do a study for them on what would be the outcome of this No Child Left Behind thing. And what they found was that its principal effect would be it would take a $100 million a year industry, the educational testing industry, a relatively small industry, and turn it into a multi-billion dollar a year industry. An industry, by the way, that George W. Bush's brother Neil had just gotten into in a big way. And that's why Jim Jeffords pulled the plug and said, that's it, I'm out of here. And you know, I'm with him on that. I think Common Core is probably an extension of that. That said, you know, I don't think that there's anything wrong with saying here are some goals that we have, but I think this teaching to the test stuff is dangerous and wrong. And you know, I think we need to be talking more about critical thinking skills. We need to get back to art and music, things that actually stimulate the brain in really, really healthy ways. We need to give more resources and more autonomy to our teachers. and reduce our class sizes. I mean, there's so much we could do that's just common sense stuff without getting into all this fancy schmancy stuff. Lee, thank you for the call. That said, though, you've got Glenn Beck and others on the right literally making a living or building an industry going after Common Core. So, you know, pick your poison. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I guess by pick your poison, what I mean is this has been, the whole Common Core thing has been so politicized that it's just dangerous waters to wade into. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. The top greatest threat over Democratic Underground right now from William Pitt. Blank you, you blanking blank. They're quoting a news story. He's quoting a news story. Former President George W. Bush is pointing to the resurgence of violence in Iraq as validating his belief that American troops should have stayed in that war-torn country instead of withdrawing in 2011. Bush told Fox News yesterday, quote, "They're not ready to do it on their own, and that's the lesson we've learned recently." And then William Pitt says, "This from the blanker who lied us into the war and finally signed a deal to withdraw all the troops he sent to Iraq in 2011. How do I know that? Because he held a press conference to announce it on December 14th, 2008, during which a guy threw shoes at him. Yes, the shoe-throwing press conference that George W. Bush held in Iraq was the one in which he announced that in 2011... all the American troops would be withdrawn, which is exactly what happened. And now Bush is saying, oh, it's Obama's fault. Talk about, I don't even know the word for it. It's obscene. Michael in Westerville, Ohio. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. Good to talk to you. I've got some news, I hope, for you and listeners. You all remember, I'm sure, the march that Granny D did in 2004.
Oh, yeah. Granny was a good friend of mine in Louise's.
Oh, wonderful. Well, we've got another one, a lady by the name of Rana Bazzini, who's an 80-year-old recently widowed activist in Florida, is doing in Granny D's footsteps.
Yes.
Starting October 13th.
I've read about it.
And she's going to be marching. Oh, good. Well, I wanted to give a little bit of additional information. She's going to be walking from Sarasota to Tallahassee, about 350 miles, and her launch is open house sort of October 12th, which will also include Jim Hightower and Lawrence Lessig. So it's beginning to get some visibility.
That's great.
And they're going to be part of the welcoming. And I think, I understand, Lawrence will be walking several days with her. Now, she's working on the Move to Amend element, which is eliminating corporate personhood and money as speech. And she wants to talk to the legislature in Tallahassee with a lot of other people, I hope, to encourage this. An amendment to the Constitution or a resolution in the Florida legislature. But what's new about this, and I talked about this with you about a year ago, is that this is bringing together faith communities of many different denominations all around the state in something that Move to Amend started over a year ago called the Interfaith Caucus. Move to Amend's basically been, I think, a secular initiative with people in hundreds of organizations working on different areas of positive change, environment, elections, education, peace, or et cetera. But what this does now, the Interfaith Caucus, is it acknowledges the fact that many of the things that corporations are doing are actually violations of the beliefs, statements, principles of many of our religions. And so we're working to bring faith communities, as well as ethical communities, humanists are very interested in this, together to form a coalition that would be potentially much more powerful than the secular part of this to move it forward towards amending the Constitution.
That's great.
And so I wanted to let you and your listeners know about this.
You just did, Michael. Is there a website?
Yeah. It's movetoamend.org/interfaith-caucus.
Okay.
And if somebody wants to get into this march, we're encouraging other states to do this. I think there's a march in New Mexico, and of course Lawrence has marched in New Hampshire. The website for Granny D is in grannydfootsteps.org, and her Facebook is in Granny D. Footsteps. I really encourage people to look into this.
Great.
And
Michael?
They go to the Moon to Men site.
There you go. Thank you very much for sharing that. Thanks. I appreciate the call. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, as you know, the nuclear industry has been calling itself green, and they're claiming to be carbon-free. And the truth is that nuclear-generated electricity is a major carbon polluter. And it's not just the mining, refining, transportation, guarding, the building and decommissioning of nuclear power plants that create a lot of carbon. There's another seldom discussed reason, and for instance, here in California, we have the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant, and the power plant is grid powered. That is to say, it takes the power from the grid, and it uses it to pump the 2.5 billion gallons of water it needs to cool the two reactors, plus run the rest of the plant and keep the spent fuel pool.
Right, this is how all of them work, Harvey. It's why when Fukushima happened and the grid got knocked out, the reactors all melted down.
That's right. And the thing is that here in California, the grid is over 50% fossil fuel powered. And so here, the nuclear power plant has been going for years, for 25 years exactly, every day, using an incredible amount of energy, and half of that, you know, and a major portion of that is like in California, it's mostly natural gas power plants and a few oil-fired power plants and out-of-state coal fire. And so that's over 50%. So how can they claim to not use any carbon? They use all that carbon in the generation of electricity.
I think increasingly, Harvey, people are realizing that the whole nuclear power is green, nuclear power is part of a transition, nuclear power is part of a, you know, an integrated basket of renewable. It is a lie. It's just a simple lie. And if it wasn't for Price Anderson, we wouldn't even have nuclear power, and we'd be a better country for it. Harvey, well said. Thank you for the call. Andy in San Pedro, California. Hey, Andy.
Good morning. Pleasure to talk with you, Tom.
Thank you.
Two things. First, back to a couple days back when you had your big talk about religion. I've always lived by my motto, and that is take your religion and keep it to yourself.
Yeah, I'm with you.
People abided by that, we wouldn't have problems that we do today.
Yep.
But your statement about Texas and the road they're going down because they didn't expand the Medicare?
Medicaid.
Oh. I have to disagree with you, and it's funny because I just kind of agreed, but then I looked down at my paper, the Press Telegram of today's front page, big across the front, ER waiting, clearly inhumane. L.A. County residents endure longer delays in treatment than most Americans.
Right.
And we took Obamacare.
No, I'm not disagreeing. Andy, please don't misunderstand me. Our healthcare system is badly broken. And I would bet that most of those L.A. area hospitals that have those kind of problems are hospitals that have been privatized and are owned by for-profit corporations now. And there's so many holes in our system. We are paying twice what most of the developed countries in the world pay on a per capita basis for healthcare in this country, with worse outcomes. So yeah, absolutely. Whether you take Medicaid or not, Medicaid expansion or not, our hospital system, our healthcare system is badly broken as a consequence of all these years of it being purely for profit and of Obamacare being based on a for profit system. No doubt about that. That said, the states that are not taking the Medicaid expansion are seeing hospitals close. I don't know if you heard when we had the mayor, the Republican mayor of a North Carolina town or South Carolina town on this program about, I don't know, a month or so ago. And he had just marched from South Carolina to Washington, D.C. to protest the fact that his state was not expanding Medicaid, or maybe it was North Carolina, it must have been North Carolina, that his state was not expanding Medicaid because the hospital in his town just closed. Small hospitals all over the United States, and this is happening in Texas as well, that used to live on basically federal subsidies that they got in exchange for caring for uninsured people. When Obamacare came in, those subsidies went away. And these hospitals, and the rationale for the subsidies going away is that now everybody who shows up at your door is going to have insurance. They'll either have Obamacare insurance or they'll have Medicaid, so you don't need subsidies anymore. So when the Supreme Court carved out this option for Republican states to say we won't take the Medicaid expansion money, they did not you know, by fiat. I suppose they could have. They seem to be very comfortable writing laws. They did not say we're going to reverse the law, the Obamacare law, and states are still going to get these subsidies, basically, for small rural hospitals that are seeing a lot of uninsured people and thus going broke. And as a consequence of this, two things are happening. Number one, you've got small hospitals closing all over the United States in red states. Hundreds of them have closed in the last year, number one. And number two, you're seeing, as a consequence of that and as a consequence of the fact that people don't have insurance, and so they don't have a doctor, so they don't go to the doctor. They wait, and you know, they wait until it's a crisis and they go to the ER. The only doctor they're seeing is in the ER. You've got long wait times in our emergency rooms. There's you know, just common sense, Andy, indicates that if people have access to a doctor, if they have health insurance, they're going to do that before they go to the ER.
True.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Andy. Good to hear from you. Henry in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Coruscant Group, you wanted to talk about?
The Coruscant Group. May I please make first, I wanted to comment on a call yesterday regarding calling people to let the folks know about, that we're coming on to an election and how important it is. And I just wanted to mention one quick little strategy, because I feel that myself, I prefer to use social media as a networking tool to alert folks about what's going on. That are in my circle.
No, I agree. Henry, we're about to hit a break here, but you wanted to know my thoughts on whether the Corazon Group was a made-up threat. I've read the reports, and I think that there's a very credible case being made that it was a made-up threat, and it troubles me. But I can't say that categorically. I don't know the details. I don't think any of us do. But this is the sort of thing that is going to probably get litigated years from now. Henry, thank you for the call. I'm with you. Social media is good. 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out GreenWorldRising.org. For our new Leo DiCaprio videos, greenworldrising.org. Welcome back. Susan in Wana, Washington. Hey, Susan, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Well, I kind of saw an obscure movie. It was called The Music Within, but it was the details of the life story of Richard Pimentel. He was the one who was the founder of ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of disheartening when you think about the UGLI law was still in effect up until 78. We did not get ADA until finally 92. And that was kind of what drove George W. to, that's Daddy Bush, George H. Walker Bush, to actually getting elected, because he was promising that he would try to help in getting the ADA passed.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. So, but we have the ADA, and it's not perfect, right? That was your
point.
No,
it is not perfect by any means. I mean,
yeah.
There's, you talk about the fracture of healthcare. It's like the fracture of even trying to find a job, trying to find housing when you have disabilities,
right.
Even trying to get into a shelter when you have disabilities.
Yeah. I'm with you. We are not treating disabled people well in this country. We're not treating anybody well in this country except the billionaires. Susan, thank you for the call. Well said. Terry in Bradford, Tennessee. Hey, Terry, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yeah, good afternoon, Tom.
Hey.
Two quick comments on voter rights. Number one, per capita, per district voting machines ought to be enacted. If there's 1,000 Republicans in a district and 5,000 Democrats in a different district, and you got 10 voting booths per 1,000, well, then the Democrat should have equal access due to the amount of voting machines.
Right.
And number two, if you enact laws on voting that it cannot be put into effect in the current 2-year federal voting cycle.
Mm-hmm.
If they have any changes whatsoever, when you go vote this November, there should be literature and all that on what to do, where to go, and how to get your voter ID for the next 2-year election cycle.
Right.
And then the last thing, the real voter fraud, goes on behind closed doors after the polls are closed, such as the 2000 election in Florida.
Yeah, and that's not voting fraud. That's electoral fraud or election fraud, and it's a big problem.
Right. You know,
this is a big problem that we've seen over and over and over again, repeatedly, almost always to the benefit of Republican candidates. This is why, in my opinion, Don Siegelman is in prison right now, is because he dared to call out Bob Riley, his opponent in 2002. Siegelman won the election. He went to bed the governor, the reelected governor of Arkansas. And when he woke up, he discovered that in the middle of the night, in one building, one Republican sitting all alone with one computer, the tabulator for that particular county or that district, discovered that there were 15,000 votes. He had won by 13,000 votes, that there were 15,000 with 000 votes that a nice even number of people who had mysteriously changed their votes overnight. They had voted for Bob Riley instead of Don Siegelman, although all the down ballot votes were for Democrats. At the top of the ballot, the governor's race, they actually had voted for a Republican. And Don Siegelman started calling this out, saying, I've been robbed. And boom, next thing you know, he's in jail. And he still is. Free-don.org is worth checking out. Terry, thank you for the call. We'll be back. Talk media for the sane among us. Tom Hartman with you. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service at the White House. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the magnet for pole vaulters everywhere?
Yes, with our double fence now.
In fact, by the way, did you see Mark Fiore's piece or his cartoon about the irony of that, of the jumper?
What was the irony?
The irony is that the guy that we got lied into the Iraq War by George W. Bush in the White House, and this guy is a PTSD victim from the Iraq War who then jumped into the White House. And nobody seems to be making that connection, that the war has come home.
Yeah, that's strange.
Yeah. Anyway, back to you.
I have Ebola news.
Okay.
Texas health officials have narrowed the list of people being tracked for possible Ebola exposure from 100 to 50. 50 in Dallas are being monitored daily. 10 are considered at high risk of developing the disease. A Washington, D.C. area hospital, Howard University Hospital, has admitted a patient with symptoms possibly associated with Ebola. The patient had traveled to Nigeria and upon returning presented symptoms that could be associated with Ebola. He's in stable, or she is in stable, we don't know, with in stable condition. And Josh Earnest today, the White House spokesperson on Air Force One, did a briefing, said that there is no consideration of a travel ban from West Africa, although some lawmakers are now calling for one. He said that a multi-layered screening system is in place to ensure that the traveling public is safe.
Right.
He said the risk of an outbreak in the U.S. is very low. He also said that the strong preference is to keep the public transport system open and safe.
Yeah. And that's interesting because I thought that the last case that was reported in Nigeria was like August 31st. They basically said, we've got this under control.
Yes.
There is no more Ebola. That's more than 21 days ago.
Yes.
So how could somebody get Ebola in Nigeria and bring it here?
Well, that's what I thought was interesting, too, because Nigeria has been saying that it's got its
eyes. So either Nigeria is lying or uninformed, or this patient has the flu.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
That's correct. Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat of Iowa today, called on Congress to increase funding to fight Ebola as part of an omnibus spending bill in the lame duck session of Congress after the elections. He said Congress should increase resources for the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, which is already involved in monitoring the first person diagnosed with Ebola. He says we must enact an omnibus bill that will provide sufficient resources to all all of the federal agencies. We cannot afford to put the government back on autopilot, hampering the work of the CDC. He said American doctors should be trained to look for Ebola symptoms, and he said the quarantine stations at 20 entry points in the U.S. should be strengthened, and that Congress should fund research for better treatment and for a potential vaccine.
Do you know if any reporters have yet asked Rick Perry or any other Republicans in states that have refused to expand Medicaid if it would not be a good idea now, given that Ebola has shown up in Texas and one quarter of the population has no health insurance whatsoever, so they're more likely not to show up at a doctor's office or hospital if they're sick, that now would be a good time to expand Medicaid simply as a public health measure?
I don't know whether anybody has asked Rick Perry that question.
Okay. It
would be an interesting question to
ask. It would be.
Yes.
What else is there?
U.S. jobs report came out today. Exceeded expectations, which were 215,000 jobs being created. Oh, no, 248,000 jobs were created in September. And the unemployment rate dropped from 6.1% to 5.9%, the lowest since July 2008. Also, the jobs numbers were revised up for both August and July.
Wow.
It's considered good news.
Yeah, and the stock market has bounced back up and the dollar's gone up.
Yeah,
as a result.
People are pleased about it. Federal Reserve will be watching it closely. It has a meeting on October the 28th and 29th.
Yeah, I don't think that they're going to consider this inflationary.
No, I don't think they are. Don't think they are. Lawmakers are calling for action on cybersecurity legislation following news that actually it's 83 million accounts, because it's 76 million household accounts and 7 million small business accounts were affected in a massive hack at JP Morgan Chase. Now, Congress has been stuck on advancing major cybersecurity legislation, but Senator Angus King for one, Senator Ed Markey for another, said they've just got to get with this. Angus King saying in a statement late yesterday, the next Pearl Harbor will be cyber, and shame on us if we're not prepared for it.
He's right.
He's right. And we have been warned multiple times by very, very senior officials working in cybersecurity in the intelligence agencies.
And this is really two issues. One is the whole cybersecurity thing, the fact that a hacker could bring down a water treatment plant, an electrical power grid, whatever, that kind of stuff. I mean, literally, we could see acts of war that would take down cities in the United States. The other part of it is, and I don't know why nobody is suggesting this, or maybe Democrats are, is how do you deal with, like, J.P. Morgan Chase being sloppy? And I think, personally, that we should deal with it with liability. We should pass laws saying that if a consumer is harmed as a result of their bank being hacked, they can sue the bank for whatever they lost plus damages. And, I mean, that works really, really well in the pharmaceutical industry. It keeps these companies relatively honest. Why not have that in banking?
Absolutely. That would seem to be the sensible
thing. And then leave it to the wonderful free market, because the bankers, once they know that they're facing serious liability and lawsuits, the possibility of class action lawsuits, they will get their act together.
Tend to focus the mind.
Yes, to paraphrase Ben Franklin. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dr. Joseph Rahm is on the line with us, the founding editor of climateprogress.org, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, chief science advisor with the Emmy Award-winning TV series Years of Living Dangerously, climateprogress.org, of course, his website. Dr. Rahm, welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. You have been writing about why California's record drought is just the beginning. Tell us about this.
Sure. Well, I think that your listeners probably familiar with the fact that California has had this brutal three-year drought, and it's really perhaps now the worst drought in recorded history. Droughts are a combination of two things, generally. You have the reduced precipitation, that's, you know, less rain, less snow, that's often directly how people think of a drought, but also high temperatures. High temperatures cause water to evaporate from soil and water to evaporate from reservoirs and everywhere else. So high temperatures also worsen droughts, and also in a place that gets a lot of water from snow caps, as the West does, the mountain snow caps are the reservoirs for places that don't get a lot of rain in the summertime. They have streams that provide water and humidification. So we're now in a situation where it is clearly hotter thanks to global warming, and it is clearly less snowfall and earlier snow melt causing worst parts of summer droughts. The big question is global warming also changing precipitation in California? That's been a subject of a bunch of recent studies, and in fact some studies 10 years ago that predicted global warming would set up a specific weather condition whereby there would be a high-pressure system off the coast of Northern California and Canada, which would divert storms and weather that would otherwise bring rain to California, would send it up north to Alaska. And as people who live in California knows, there has been this thing called the ridiculously resistant ridge of high pressure, the three R's. And there have been two major studies this year which said that global warming makes such blocking patterns, patterns that get stuck, far more likely. And the latest study led by Stanford concluded that this particular blocking pattern over the Pacific Ocean that diverts storms is about three times more likely because of greenhouse gas concentrations. And there are many studies that make a more general argument that global warming is going to cause weather patterns to stall, and I know of more studies that are yet to come. So I think there's a growing case that yes, global warming is affecting and worsening and making this particular drought much worse and much more likely and much more likely to last a long time than it would have been just if it had been, you know, kind of random weather.
Right. I've heard a description, and I'd like you to reality check this for me. There's been a lot of talk about this. We live in a marina down here in D.C., and there's a lot of guys who are just total weather freaks down there, mariners and pilots and whatnot. I'm a pilot. And the argument is that the jet stream, this river of cold air that at high altitudes that circles the North Pole, or circles, you know, north of us anyway, that it has historically been held in place by the differential in temperature, by the gradient in temperature between the mid-latitudes where we are here and the Arctic latitudes. And because the Arctic is warming five or six times faster than mid-latitudes like here in D.C., that temperature gradient has deteriorated to the point that the main thing that's holding the jet stream up are now geographic features like the mountain ridge that starts in Alaska and runs, you know, through the Rocky Mountains and down into the central part of the United States. And that's one of the reasons why, A, we're seeing the jet stream not, you know, or we're seeing weird weather in California, but also, B, why this incredibly cold Arctic air is just drooling over the eastern half of the United States, or the central and eastern part of the United States, you know, sort of like a yarmulke sliding off the top of a head. Because the jet stream is not there to block it anymore, and this might even be the new normal. Your thoughts on that?
Yes, well, I think those points are true, but, you know, let me put it this way. We know things with varying levels of certainty. You know, we know that human carbon pollution is warming the planet, changing the climate with the same degree of confidence that we know cigarette smoking kills, causes cancer.
Right.
So very, very high confidence. What you've described is emerging science. It's emerged because the Arctic has been losing ice literally decades faster than people thought would happen. And I think most of your listeners have noticed that just in the last several years, the weather has gotten much stranger, much more extreme events, once-in-a-thousand-year events happening all sorts of places. And there has now been a growing body of literature that says, yes, the loss of Arctic ice is weakening the jet stream. If you've had Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers on, she's one of the leading experts on it. If you haven't, I certainly would urge you to have her because she can explain this much better than anyone I know. But it is basically the case that much of the weather in the Northern Hemisphere, certainly much of the weather in North America, is driven by this temperature difference between the warmth in the tropics and the warmth in the Gulf of Mexico and the cold in the Arctic.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, the Arctic has been warming considerably faster than the rest of the planet, which has long been predicted. We knew that would be the case. But the loss of Arctic ice dramatically shifts the temperature balance, and that's because when you have ice covering the ice cap, you can have temperatures like 60, 70, 80 degrees below zero Fahrenheit,
mm-hmm.
above ice. But above open water, it's going to be freezing.
32 degrees Fahrenheit.
There's such a massive heat content in water that basically uncovering the Arctic in the late spring, over the summer, and early fall allows a massive amount of extra heat to be emitted into the system from the water.
Because water's so much more dense, it'll hold more heat.
Well, it's there's a scientific term, heat capacity. Obviously, anybody knows that if you touch a hot metal, you grab your pot, you can get burned. But if you let go really quickly, not so bad. But you can't put your hand on the top of boiling water. Right. It's just going to convey too much heat to you.
Yeah.
So as a result, we are seeing a dramatic shift in the balance of temperatures, and by all evidence, the jet stream is weakening. Now, the jet stream is what keeps weather patterns moving along. And if the jet stream weakens and in particular forms big loops, stuff can get stuck in those loops.
Yeah.
And you can get these
bad things happen.
Heats, and which we've had, and then in 2012, of course, we had worse heat.
Right. Dr. Rahm, we're out of time, but thank you so much for dropping by. Dr. Joseph Rahm, climateprogress.org. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Joe Rahm's website, climateprogress.org. Check it out. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Back to Anything Goes Friday. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ellen, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Quartzsite, Arizona. Hey, Ellen.
Hey. Just for openers, thank you, whoever took the block off my phone. Since I called you guys a few weeks ago, you and Bill Press.
Uh-huh.
My phone's been blocked from Free Speech TV.
Really?
Well,
your calls do not go via Free Speech TV. You're calling us directly here in Washington, D.C. Free Speech TV's up.
I can get any number. Yours or Bill's or Stephanie's or anybody's number was blocked for me for weeks after those calls I made to you.
Oh, is that strange? You should talk to your phone company because we had nothing to do with
it. Well, I think maybe they're the ones that lifted the block. I can't blame them.
Yeah.
You know, Net10, good going. They lifted the block.
We'll
put it on there. But I just wanted to reiterate, I think it was Bill Press, where the lady called up and challenged everybody to take two people to the polls who wouldn't have got there otherwise.
Right.
And I will up that challenge to get two people registered.
Yeah, that was somebody on our show who made that challenge, as I recall. Although they might have called into Bill's show and Stephanie's show, too. Who knows? But yeah.
Okay. Well, there was that, and I'm going to add one thing. If you're a felon, and you know whether you have a right to be or not, and you can't vote, you should dedicate yourself to getting at least two people of like mind out to vote, because somebody stole your vote.
Yeah.
That's there, my theory.
There you go.
Okay, and then just a little bit more, which is, does everybody remember when the Art Bell Show, Coast to Coast, used to have people pray to put out forest fires?
I never listened to Art Bell, but it doesn't surprise me.
Take my word for it, darling. The power of prayer does work. And if you really don't like somebody, pray for them. That's the best way to settle their hash. As a buddy of mine used to say, major blast of love and light.
Yeah.
It'll empower.
Well, Jesus said that just explicitly. He said, pray for your enemies.
It will empower your friends and cut your enemies off at the knees.
There you go.
Love and light burns them like fire. And that's all I have to say. I love you guys. God, stay alive and keep on doing your job.
Thank you, Ellen. I very well said. Thank you. Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. A comment and a question. Mm-hmm. The comment is, every time I hear Bernie and Elizabeth Warren says the rich people have the power because they have the money, I would disagree with them and say they get their power from us, and we need to learn how to redirect it. As long as we give our power to them, we have no reason to, you know, to blame them. We have ourselves to blame if we keep giving them the power they use over us.
Yeah, I'm not willing to play blame the victim, Jesse.
No, I'm saying I don't believe in that neither, but I'm saying if we're going to have any leverage to doing anything about why we are the way we are, we need to do what God says. You know, God help those who help themselves.
God didn't say that. Ben Franklin said that. And
okay, well, that sounds close enough to God.
Well, Ben Franklin was an atheist, so he said it as a joke, actually.
Forever, but the question is just as relevant with Ben Franklin and them people is the George Washington freed the Revolution, freed the men, white men of property. What was the situation that freed the indebted white people that came over from England? Because you could use that same logic, that economical system that they was in debt to, we have it today.
Yeah.
So that's the question.
Okay.
So thanks,
Jesse.
What you do.
Thank you very much for the call. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Dan in Simpsonville, South Carolina. Hey, Dan, you wanted to talk about political donors?
Yeah, I was watching Morning Joe this morning, and they had the top five donors for 2013-2014.
Right.
The NRA was five with $10 million. One of your climate groups was four with $11 million. Karl Rove Crossroads was three at $16 million. Chamber of Commerce, number two at $25 million, and lo and behold, it was Harry Reid that was number one with the Senate pack at $32 million.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you always rail against Charles Koch and all those guys. They weren't even in the top five.
Well, here's how the Koch brothers have managed to give.
Charles Koch was not American. What?
Here's how the Koch brothers have managed to spend $407 million. That's last year. They've exceeded that so far this year without making those lists. Those lists are lists of people who have given money to specific political campaigns. The Koch brothers, instead, last year passed out $407 million. This year it's much larger than that, $407 million compared to all those numbers that you just listed. By giving it to 501c3s, groups like, and 501c4s, groups like SHA LLC or Aura LLC, they've got all these, Americans for Prosperity, all these groups that are not directly affiliated with any particular candidate or campaign. So they'll go into a state and they'll say, okay, we want the Republican to win here. We're going to take down the Democrat, but we're not going to run ads saying that Democrat is a bad person. Instead, we're going to run ads saying that Democrat voted this way and that was wrong. In other words, it's an issue ad. It's not a political ad. And therefore, because they're not giving money to a political campaign, and because they're not, in theory, by the very finest legal definition, they're not knocking another political candidate. They can do this with a fairly high level of anonymity, at least, you know, prior to the election cycle. So the Koch brothers are far and away, and Joe Scarborough, of course, wouldn't want you to know this because he's an old Republican congressman and he's a Republican shill on MSNBC.
But he's sitting
$407 million out of the Koch brothers. They got the same meme. I mean, the Koch brothers and the Republicans are pushing this really hard. They got it on NPR yesterday. They got NPR saying the same thing, and it's a lie. You know, Dan, the information that you're conveying is just not accurate. I mean, it's accurate it's a classic example of the old saying, figures don't lie, but liars can figure. The reality is, as I said, you're quoting numbers about who's giving money to political campaigns. The Senate PAC, of course, they give money to political campaigns. That's all they do. But in involving themselves in the election process, no, the Koch brothers are far and away the biggest. David in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, David, what's up?
Well, what's up is I just have a request, Tom. Could we please stop heaping praise on Henry Ford?
Yeah. You know, Bernie likes that story, and it's a good story. The fact of the matter is, and I've talked about this before, okay. Henry Ford did this because his wife and his business partner forced him to. He took credit for it afterwards, but his business partner, Perkins was his name? He was a state senator from Michigan. He ultimately ended up being a state senator. He wanted to be a U.S. senator. And he was very
James
progressive.
Cousin.
Pardon?
James Cousin.
James Cousin, was that
James
his name?
Cousin.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And Henry Ford's wife, who was very progressive. Ford was a regressive, troglodyte, racist, anti-Semite. And they basically said, his business partner said, I'm not going to be your partner anymore. And his wife said, you're not going to sleep with me anymore if you don't do this. And boom, everybody got $5 an hour. But
No. Research,
or $5 a day.
No more than 2% of Ford's total employee staff ever got $5 a day.
Oh, really?
It was a total PR stunt.
Well, that's interesting. Okay. I'm going to have
no
to.
No more than 2%.
I'm going to have to dig into that a little more because the Dodge brothers, when they sued him in this famous Michigan Supreme Court case, which I have read,
right,
which is Dodge v. Ford. They asserted that he was paying, large portions of his, large enough part of his workforce, this $5 a day, that it was impacting their business, their ability to get good employees.
Well, I don't know where that came from. I thought
that was the basis of their lawsuit.
All right. Well, it's hard to believe that a guy who would hire Pinkertons to club and shoot his employees to death or when they were on strike to get better wages, to slow down the assembly line. People don't realize that assembly lines can be made at different speeds.
Right.
And he just gradually, slowly increased it faster and faster until these guys, it was driving them crazy and driving them to death.
Right.
Because it was so fast. It's hard to believe that a guy that would do that, which thinks so much of his workers that he wanted to have, enough money to buy his own product.
Right. No, I'm with you. Henry Ford, as I said, he did take credit for it afterwards, though. He bragged about it, but he got a lot of PR for it. You're right. David, I'm going to have to dig that story out one of these days and go through it. Thanks for the reminder, and thanks for listening to 880 AM. Clay in Shelton, Washington, listening to KMAS. Hey, Clay, what's up?
Hey, good day, sir.
Good day to you.
You said something about George W. Bush making a comment about Barack Obama being the reason we're still at war.
Yeah, he said he blamed Obama for ISIS, and he said that, here's his exact quote, and this is in Iraq. He said, they're not ready to do it on their own, Iraq, and that's the lesson we've learned recently. He said this on Fox News yesterday, George W. Bush. This is the guy who negotiated and his press conference on December 14th, 2008, announced that we would be pulling out of Iraq in 2011. But now he's blaming Obama for it on Fox News.
Okay. Well, you were looking for a word to describe that, right?
Yeah.
I believe the word would be asinine.
Yeah, that's about as close to the words you can say that on the radio. And, it's hypocritical. Once again, a liar. I mean, but, you know, Fox News, of course, just regurgitated this, you know, played it through. Nobody challenged him. Nobody questioned him. Nobody played the clip from 2008 when he, you know, made the announcement, December 14th, 2008, when he made the announcement that we would be pulling out of Iraq in 2011. Nobody at Fox News, of course. But, Clay, thank you for the call. And that's a good word, asinine. I think that's a very good word to describe George W. Bush's behavior. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And check out our new videos over at greenworldrising.org. Minutes before the hour, another state that has not expanded Medicaid and so is incredibly vulnerable to public health crises, Georgia. This is from WSB-TV in Atlanta. Cobb County Jail is no longer accepting inmates after an inmate developed a fever. The man told jail officials that he recently traveled from Africa. Steve. In Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yeah, I think the Mr. Rom's concern about the drought is a little bit overblown since we have the a Parsons designed something in 1950 to, you know, dam up the rivers on the north of Alaska and Yukon and channel water through the Rocky Mountains back down to California.
Via Canada?
Yeah, well, it'll be from Alaska back to Canada. There's a 1,000-mile reservoir, natural reservoir, in the Rocky Mountains that we could fill with billions of gallons of water.
Wow.
And it would allow the entire area to be irrigated from the Mississippi River to the Pacific Ocean. It would generate enough food and labor jobs to, you know, make the United States a...
Steve, I have never heard of that. And, you know, if it's true, good luck selling it. One of the big problems with reservoirs or water, that's coming basically from snowmelt, which I'm presuming is what this is that we are seeing glaciers melting at a record rate. In fact, Glacier National Park will have no glaciers within a decade. Most of the glaciers are already gone. We're seeing there's a real crisis happening right now in parts of India because the Himalayan glaciers are receding. They're having droughts in Europe because so many of the glaciers in the Alps are vanishing. There's a huge crisis down in South America along that mountain ridge in the Andes, I believe it is, up across the it would be the northwestern edge of the South American continent, going through Ecuador and I'm forgetting the other country there, but because the glaciers are vanishing. Even the glacier on Kilimanjaro that Ernest Hemingway wrote about in his short story Snows of Kilimanjaro, which is just a killer short story, by the way, it's amazing. Where, you know, there's that leopard frozen up at the top on that glacier. That glacier's gone now. So, you know, saying that we should rely on glaciated water or snowmelt from high places, maybe if we put together a multi-billion-dollar public works program and put a lot of people to work, pumping water from Colorado to California, assuming you could get the states to go along with it, or Alaska to California, might over the short term work. But over the long term, what we need to do is stop putting carbon into our atmosphere. Jim in San Diego. Hey, Jim.
Hi. I'm calling about a topic I don't know much about, thorium. Molten salt reactors,
right.
And it appears to be a dead cow. Nobody's talking about it.
Right.
Apparently, thorium is much more abundant than uranium. They will not melt down, and so that you wouldn't have a result like we had in Japan.
Right. The thorium reactors are said to be safer and cheaper and, you know, all kinds of wonderful stuff, but it's still nuclear power. and you're still producing radiation. You're still handling radioactive material. You're still having to mine radioactive material. You're having to transport radioactive material. You're having to refine radioactive material. And, you know, they say that with the thorium reactors, there's less waste, but it's still, I mean, this is, it's still nuclear power. And I think that that's why, you know, if there was any commercial potential for this, there is no doubt in my mind that Duke Energy or GE or one of these other companies that builds nuclear reactors or runs nuclear power plants, in a heartbeat, if this was good science, they'd be doing it. There's, you know, there's no grand conspiracy to stop.
I heard that there was a working plant, and Carter shut it down because of the fear over Three Mile Island.
Not to the best of my knowledge, Jim. And that was 40 years ago. You would not, okay. You know, if there was, they just commissioned. I mean, they're building right now in Georgia two nuclear power plants, and they're both boiling water nuclear reactors. They're modern versions of the Fukushima style reactors. And there is just, I mean, this is just so clear. You know, if there was a more efficient, less expensive.
I'm not for nuclear power, but if the half-life is so much less and they're so much safer,
right.
I sure would rather have them put up a thorium reactor than a nuclear reactor.
We now have roofing shingles that are photovoltaic cells that generate electricity. Germany put this program together 13 years ago, where if you owned your home, you could get a low-interest bank loan to put solar panels on your house and sell power back to the power company, and it all worked out where basically it didn't cost anybody anything. Germany is now generating half their electricity from sun and wind. And Germany is a well-developed, large industrial power with a huge railroad system that all runs on electricity. You know, we have the ability, if we simply put solar panels on the roof of every house in America, overnight, we no longer need nuclear power plants, we don't need oil, we don't need any of it. You know, we still need oil for transportation, we've got to deal with that. But it's, you know, this is no longer speculation. It was when Jimmy Carter was president and he was moving us in that direction. But it is solid, established, we're within, you know, a penny or so of the cost of fossil fuels. And if we actually had the fossil fuel industry pay for the externalities, pay for the cancers, pay for the asthma, pay for the cost of the military protecting their shipping lanes, fossil fuels would be massively more expensive than solar or wind. So we're there, Jim. I don't think we need to worry about thorium.
I'm going to leave you with another question and get off the air and let you answer. Is there any constructive way for me to vent my anger at Fox News? And thanks for your
anger about what?
Your input towards Fox News.
Yeah. You mean just the way that they cover things?
It's horrendous.
Fox News has a mortal enemy.
I don't know how they get away with calling themselves a news agency.
That's why I refer to them as Fox so-called news. I think that's the biggest. I have no problem with Fox if they would just call themselves Fox Commentary, but they pretend that they're doing news. They have a mortal enemy.
Thank you very much. Thanks for okay.
Here's Jim. Let me give you an answer.
Okay.
They have Fox has a mortal enemy in the group MediaMatters.org. And Media Matters every single day calls out Fox on their lies of the day. And if you haven't visited Media Matters website, and they even have Ari Ravenhoff has a radio show on SiriusXM. And if you haven't been over to their website, it is really worth checking out, MediaMatters.org. And, you know, spreading the word, just taking those stories from Media Matters and pushing them out to your friends, pushing them, you know, putting them on Facebook, putting them, you know, emailing them out to people. That's how you reveal the corruptness, you know, how corrupt Fox News is. Jim, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Morris in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Hey, Professor, I got a little tune to help get the people motivated to vote. Really short.
Okay.
I'm voting, and I don't like war. More talk, more peace. Maybe send a Peace Corps. I'm voting. I'm voting to change. We got a government that says the corporation are men. I'm voting. You know it's the fact. Politicians taking money. Some are smoking the crack. I'm voting. Like a bowl of cherries. We got to get together. People got to cut the military. I'm voting. Yeah, that's right.
All you need is some music under that. That's great. Morris,
yeah,
you
should.
Go ahead. Oh, okay, Morris, thank you. Thanks for the call. That was superlative. Jerry in Long Island. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, how you doing? Good. By the way, my simple saying is, if you don't vote, then don't emote it and complain. But I'd like to discuss the Secret Service and the two gun-related breaches in presidential security. But I'd like to discuss in the larger context of in terms of what we do about our nation's overly lenient and crazy gun laws. For instance, first of all, we had a person get their hands on this overly powerful firearm that's literally, and I say literally, modeled after a weapon of war, the M16 rifle, you know, these assault weapons, and he fires it at the White House with both the president's daughter and his grandmother inside, and with the bullets only, thank God, being stopped by the technology of bulletproof glass.
Right.
It was only that technology of bulletproof glass that stopped it, and yet virtually no one is questioning why any civilian should be allowed to legally purchase such a powerful military style assault rifle. And then we had this, and then in addition, we had the second incident where we had this armed man with a criminal history of assault who had no business buying any kind of firearm whatsoever. Still, nonetheless, he bought the firearm, got on an elevator with this president. And so, once again, I'm left questioning and wondering.
He was working for a security contract. That venue had privatized their security. So.
Right. Right. Well, in addition to that, we have no criminal background checks. Maybe if we had a universal criminal background check law, the security company would have found out that he had this criminal background. They never would have hired him. They said, look, you cannot be armed if you have this criminal background. We won't hire you. But he was hired, which gave a sense of complacency. Both.
Yeah, I would say, you know, a criminal history or a history of violence, particularly at all, should be the same thing as a history of drunk driving with regard to having a driver's license. That should be the same relative to the ability to buy a gun. I'm with you, Jerry. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out GreenWorldRising.org to see the two new videos that we have up, narrated by Leonardo DiCaprio. Welcome back. Cheryl in Lapine, Alabama. Am I saying that right, Cheryl? Cheryl, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Alabama? Cheryl is listening to her TV, not her phone. You got to listen to your phone because there's a delay on the TV. Lewis in Dunedin, Florida, watching Free Speech TV? Dunedin?
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Hey, Lewis, what's on your mind?
Well, I've always wondered about the possibility that Lincoln freed the slaves. Could he have given them education at the same time? And what kind of a world would we have today?
Yeah, well, in fact, there were efforts to educate slaves, former slaves, freed slaves, in the early years of Reconstruction, in the late 1860s, early 1870s. They were championed by the radical Republicans, they were referred to as. They were the abolitionists, the remnants of the Republican Party that were still the kind of Abe Lincoln Republican Party. By 1875, 1880, certainly, the Republican Party had been taken over by the railroad barons and you know, as the Industrial Revolution got under steam, by the Andrew Carnegies and the John Rockefellers of the world. But there was a substantial effort to educate freed slaves. Then that went in reverse. And it went in reverse on steroids at the end of the 19th century with the Plessy versus Ferguson decision in 1898. So I think that had we embraced the vision of the radical Republicans and you know, full enfranchisement, full benefits, full access to, quote, white society or what was then, you know, exclusively white society for people of all races. And by the way, both genders, you know, let's keep in mind, black men were theoretically freed before even white women, much less black women, were freed. I think, you know, we could have done a lot. I mean, there's a lot that could have happened. So, Lewis, thank you for the call. Excellent question. Richard in South Stratford, Vermont. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Yeah, good afternoon, Tom. I'm in Bernie land here.
Oh, great.
Yeah. In December 1964, I was in Barcelona, Spain, and the nuclear ship Savannah pulled up, and people went on looking over it, on tours. It was designed to spread how nuclear power could be used for peaceful commercial uses. I don't think there's any U.S. Commercial cargo ships anymore, but I think Russia might still have some. Of course, we have nuclear subs and I think aircraft carriers.
Yeah.
Maybe you could talk more about the Price-Anderson Act, no fault,
Sure. Well, let me summarize it real quickly, Richard, because we're going to hit a break in just a second. When nuclear power was being popularized in the 50s, the problem was that there wasn't a single insurance company in the world that would insure a nuclear power plant because there was just too much risk. And you couldn't buy a policy for any reasonable price. And so the federal government stepped in with the Price-Anderson Act and said that we, the federal government, will be the insurer of last resort for nuclear power plants. If there are any problems at all, we are going to pick up, you know, the cost. And it's only because of Price-Anderson that we even have nuclear power in the United States. The so-called free market would have eliminated nuclear power if Congress hadn't passed Price-Anderson. And it should eliminate nuclear power now, and we should repeal Price-Anderson, in my opinion. Okay, Richard?
I was on the Lawrence station at Ebi and the Marshalls in 1952, that whole year.
Oh, my. See, you saw it. Richard, I'm sorry we're out of time, but thank you for sharing your story with us. We'll be back. Ten minutes before the hour. You can tell it's Friday. Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our board op, Troy Miller, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at the various companies that syndicate this program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, on Dish Network and DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show as well, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, etc., all the good folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio at netrootsradio.com, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Nay, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. It is genuinely appreciated. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Marty, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, happy Friday.
Thank you.
Hey, I was thinking about your friend Horace's comment the other day on The Big Picture, that where he was basically saying that he doesn't want imprisoned felons to be able to cast votes,
right.
I believe is a point that he had made.
Well, he didn't even want ex-felons to be able to cast a vote.
You know, I was thinking about that, and I wanted to know if you thought voter rights should be extended to people that are presently incarcerated. I mean, should there be voting booths in jails and prisons? I mean, go on.
The impact of that on an election would be pretty insignificant. But I think you could argue that one of the problems with doing that would be that many prisons don't represent the local population. There happens to be a prison there, and there's, you know, a lot of people there, and it's a small town nearby, and you know, if all the prisoners were voting, they might be able to flip things like city council elections. That's the only argument that I've ever heard that makes any sense about why we shouldn't let people who are felons vote. I think the idea that if somebody has committed a crime, broken the law, that they have put themselves outside of society and outside of our body politic, and therefore should play no role in it. You can argue that, and I wouldn't dispute it with regard to somebody who is imprisoned or on parole, but I think that once somebody has, quote, paid their debt to society, once their parole is over, then they should have full rights back. If you're not going to get your full rights back, then why go through what for some people is a very, very difficult process of being rehabilitated, as it were, of reintegrating yourself into society. So I'm in favor of saying that little box on an employment form that says, have you ever been arrested or convicted of a crime, should not be there by law. That's not the business of an employer, unless that employer is in a security business or something like that. But Marty, that's my take on it. So thanks a lot for the call. Rick in Andover, Minnesota. Hey, Rick, you wanted to talk about global warming?
Yes. First of all, I wanted to say I enjoy your show. I don't often agree with you because I'm conservative, but you're the one show that I listen to because I think you do make some real good points sometimes, and that stuff isn't heard on the other side. So, but anyway, I'm a scientist, an atmospheric scientist, and I did a study I think you'd be interested in. I talked to people, and right now I've talked to 157, and out of that 157, only two people have said that they agree that there's climate change and global warming caused by CO2. So I think you're kind of in the minority. Now, I'm not lying about this. I thought it was real interesting.
I believe you, Rick. If you're a conservative, odds are your friends are, your family are. You're talking to people. This is one of the problems in our body politic right now, is that liberals are only reading the liberal websites. Conservatives are only reading the conservative websites. Liberals are listening to progressive talk radio. Conservatives are listening to conservative talk radio. And we don't talk to each other.
Well, that's not true because I'm driving a truck, so I'm just talking to different people that's shipping and receiving and truck stops, sort of thing. So it has nothing to do with politics.
Well, actually, I think it does. The trucking world, you know, anywhere in America, you can get Rush Limbaugh. You can't, unless you have Sirius Radio, you can't get this program anywhere in America, for example.
Okay. But here's the thing I want to challenge you on. And one of the things that you would believe is that Earth's mean temperature is a function of CO2, correct?
In part.
In part. Exactly.
There are a number of things that affect it. CO2, methane, the albedo effect, solar output, the wobble of the planet. I mean, we know that there's a 360,000-year cycle that has to do with the wobble of the planet. There's all kinds of things that affect the mean temperature.
There's 600, more than 600 things. As a matter of fact, if you take your first class in cloud physics, because I'm a meteorologist, you almost laugh at global warming because you realize that the climate is caused by clouds, which is caused by cosmic rays.
Well, I would say that, Rick, when your research has been published in a peer-reviewed journal, call us back and let us know. Thanks for the call. John in Boulder, Colorado. You wanted to talk about the God helps those who help themselves quote. I thought it was Ben Franklin. It wasn't?
Yes, you're correct that phrase did not come from the Bible, but it came into the culture much earlier than Ben Franklin. Uh-huh. The first English phrasing of those words came from an English philosopher named Algernon Sidney. It was in the 1680s.
Whoa.
But it's been, various versions have been in Aesop's Fables and Greek mythology long before that.
Wow. Yeah. So this kind of neo-Calvinism, the idea that the Calvinists were like, you know, we've got to figure out who's going to rule us. Well, it should be somebody that God has blessed. So how do we know who God has blessed? Oh, it's the rich people, obviously. Let them be the rulers. That thinking goes back a long, long ways.
Yes, and in fact, Sidney lost his life for espousing that view. He countered the Hobbesian argument that coercive power of the monarchy was necessary.
Right. That's interesting. So he was actually one of the early liberals.
Yes.
Yeah, fascinating. John, thank you for that. I've got to tell you, we've got the smartest listeners in all of radio or television. I learn something every day. Thank you so much for being with us throughout this week. We'll see you next week. And don't forget, in the meantime, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require participation. And just voting is not enough. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.